12. It was a criminal act to warm that beautiful coffee up in the microwave, but I did it anyway, because I hadn't drunk more than an inch worth. I sang something, some stupid song from the 80s, I don't even remember which one, probably about love, or cocaine, or driving fast cars, or maybe all three. And one was a euphemism for another, and then I couldn't remember the next line, and so I sang Jingle Bells, and then the coffee was hot. I had to grab the handle with my shirt because it was too hot to touch. Probably the words that the girl said could not be written down were not about a one-horse open sleigh. It didn't seem likely. I glanced out the window and saw that it was still light. That seemed strange somehow, like when you come out of a movie theater and are startled to see that it's still daylight. It seemed like it should be much later. It seemed like half the day should have passed, and it should be past midnight. By the clock, I think it had been about 45 minutes. Long enough for coffee to go cold, not much longer. I walked through the house and turned on every light. I cranked the radio up and then ran the ice maker, not because I needed ice, but because it was loud, and I needed it to be loud in the house right then. You're going to think I am entirely mad, but I proceeded to fire up my laptop and play three games of solitaire at high speed. I just needed to do something that wasn't reading. Something where black cards went on red cards and nines went on tens and everything made sense. As soon as I got stuck, I restarted. It probably took about 5 minutes. It wasn't even long enough for the pledge week to break back into the radio program, which was a lengthy discussion of a coup, except that I'd missed what country it was in. I wondered who I was supposed to be rooting for, the military or the government, because both sounded pretty bad. When Elaine Rogers came back on, sounding punchy and tired, I closed the laptop. I wondered if poor Elaine slept during pledge week. I would have traded places with her. She could have my grandmother's house and my step-grandfather Cockgrave and a ring of hills in winter like dark curtains, and I twisted myself around like the twisted ones. I grabbed the coffee mug. The handle was too hot still, and I swore and drank it anyway and burned the roof of my mouth, and that was fine. A burned mouth was a thing I understood. It had nothing to do with twisted stones and songs that must not be spoken and Vorish domes, whatever the hell those were. I'm being stupid. I knew that line had to come from the Green Book. He said it did. I should have expected to see it. It just startled me, that's all. Truth was, the litany of the twisted ones had been growing in my mind since I read it days before. Not that I kept thinking it the way Cockgrave had, but I kept seeing it or remembering it at odd moments, and the idea of it had gone from, what is my step-grandfather smoking anyway, to poor old fellow was obsessed, to something else. Something I couldn't put words around. It was, okay, you remember The Shining? I felt like I was flipping through a stack of papers that said, all work and no play, over and over again. But I hadn't yet turned around to see Jack Nicholson standing there grinning at me. The radio blared. Someone was delivering a testimonial about how much community radio meant to them. Rogers told us about how grateful they were for people like the Bolanders, who really understood what a service the station provided. I wondered if the Bolanders got matching hoodies. I picked up the page I had dropped. I forced my eyes to finish the line that they'd stopped at. Then I made faces like the faces on the rocks, and I twisted myself about like the twisted ones, and I lay down flat on the ground like the dead ones, and I went up to one that was grinning and put my arms round him and hugged him. And so I went on and on through the rocks, and it was a long, long way. There was a gap in the text here, and it started again on the next page. Cotgrave had thoughtfully labeled each page in the corner in blue ballpoint pen, so I knew I was going in the right order. I felt a pang of sympathy for the old man, who had to stop in nearly the same place that I had. Looking back on what I wrote out yesterday, I believe that it is mostly accurate, or at least as close as I can come. It may be that it is tainted by my own experience of the stones. Or perhaps, since I read the Green Book long before I climbed the hill myself, my experience of the stones was tainted by reading the book. Are hers the same as the ones I saw in Wales? There is no way to tell. I knew enough to turn away in any event. If I had gone on, perhaps I would have seen what she saw, or perhaps I would not be here to write this. In any event, I do not remember the rest of this part so clearly. The girl went to a place in the middle of the hill and climbed a tower or a hill to a high place, I think, and looked down on the stones and saw them all ranged in patterns. She becomes dizzy, and the patterns began to spin, and then she climbs down. I danced as I went in the peculiar way the rocks had danced, and I was so glad I could do it quite well. And I danced and danced along, and sang extraordinary songs that came into my head. She continues on, possibly through another tunnel, while dancing in this fashion, and describes being stung by nettles and thorns, but they only make her tingle, and she does not mind this, because of the singing. There are many stories, of course, of religious pilgrims scouring themselves and becoming insensitive to pain, swamis walking on hot coals and so forth, so perhaps it is something like that. I remember when Ambrose and I first spoke, firewalking was considered a baffling mystical art. And yet I saw a television program on firewalking last month that explained how it was done with physics. Perhaps someday, even things like the Green Book will be explained by physics, and there will be no more of Ambrose's passions of the lonely soul. If firewalking is in the natural order after all, as it seems, then what more may we yet learn? Perhaps a day will come when all things can be fit somehow in the natural order, and then Ambrose's definition of sin will be of no more use to us. Then again, as isolated as I am now, perhaps we have explained many things already. The firewalking program may be only one. She thought it was interesting and left it on. I think she was hoping someone would burn themselves, but no one did. I snorted out loud at that last bit. It had been a margin note in blue pen. Cotgrave had no more illusions about his wife than any of the rest of us did, apparently. Ambrose spoke often of how terrifying it would be if flowers began to sing to us, or a dog to speak, in violation of the natural order. He spoke of such violation as the true form of sin. And yet now there are theme parks where you can go and mechanical flowers will sing, movies where dogs will talk. Have we thus all begun to sin, or have our senses become numbed so that we will no longer recognize true sin when we see it? To continue, much of the rest of The White Day is an account of travel. There are thickets and valleys and ferns. She drinks from a stream which gives her a kiss and believes that there is a nymph within it. She comes to a wall of moss and believes that it is the end of the world, after which is only the kingdom of Vor, where the light goes when it is put out, and the water goes when the sun takes it away. I wondered how I should get home again, if I could ever find the way, and if my home was there anymore, or if it were turned and everybody in it into gray rocks, as in the Arabian Nights. I sat down on the grass and thought what I should do next. I was tired, and my feet were hot with walking.
She finds a well nearby, the bottom covered in red sand that is constantly stirring, and puts her feet into it to soak. Climbing the wall, she sees the queerest country, full of hills and hollows, and two large mounds like beehives.
It was so strange and solemn and lonely, like a hollow temple of dead heathen gods.
She then recounts a lengthy story told by her nurse of a hollow that was a bad place where people did not dare to go. A poor girl goes in. She claims the hollow is full of grass and stones and flowers, and is later seen wearing extravagant jewelry. When asked, she says the emeralds are grass, the rubies and diamonds only stones. She goes to the court of the king and queen wearing a crown of pure angel gold, which she claims is only yellow flowers in her hair. The king's son marries her, but on his wedding night, there is a tall black man with a dreadful face standing outside the door, saying, "Venture not upon your life. This is my own wedded wife." It may have been mine own or some other construction. The bedroom is full of screaming and shrieking and crying. They cut the door open with hatchets and find only black smoke and the remains of flowers and stones. After recounting this story, the girl says a charm that her nurse taught her to ward off the black man and keep bad things away. Still not sure now who or what the nurse was. At first I thought she was one of the white people herself, but now I wonder if she may have been one of their servants, or what my mother used to call cunning folk, or perhaps the nurse was both, or a half-breed of sorts. Ambrose suggested once that the girl may have been a changeling, that perhaps the white people breed with humans and then send their servants to train them until they are old enough to take their place among their elders. I rubbed my hands over my face. My eyes were swimming from reading, especially from reading Cotgrave's cramped margin notes in ballpoint pen. Well, the story of the poor girl and the stones was a fairly straightforward pact with the devil, with a little old-fashioned racism thrown in. By itself, it wasn't proof of anything, except that the nurse had strange ideas about bedtime stories. To continue the narrative, she travels on even farther, finding a certain wood, which is too secret to be described, and nobody knows of the passage into it, which I found out in a very curious manner, by seeing some little animal run into the wood. After this, there is very little concrete written, only that she sees the most wonderful sight. She does not describe it at any point, but runs away back home. She lies in bed, attempting to remember this wonderful sight, but cannot see it clearly. It is referred to afterward as the wonderful secret, which she knows and others do not. The girl herself begins to wonder if her nurse was one of the beautiful white people. After this point, the chronology of the Green Book becomes even more jumbled. Or perhaps my memory of it is worse than I thought. She refers to several stories told to her by her nurse, which begin in the time of the fairies. One is about a young man who chases a white stag until he enters a fairy mound and meets the queen of fairies. She gives him wine to drink from a golden cup, shades of Parsifal. And when he awakens, he will not drink wine or kiss another woman for the rest of his life. Ambrose was most interested in a tale about a hill where people used to meet at night long ago, and they used to play all sorts of strange games and do queer things that Nurse told me of. I only remember one stretch of it well, but there was a great deal to it, much of it repetitive. And the song was in an old, old language that nobody knows now, and the tune was queer. Nurse said her great-grandmother had known someone who remembered a little of it when she was quite a little girl, and Nurse tried to sing some of it to me, and it was so strange a tune that I turned all cold and my flesh crept as if I had put my hand on something dead. Sometimes it was a man that sang, and sometimes it was a woman, and sometimes the one who sang it did it so well that two or three of the people who were there fell to the ground, shrieking and tearing. Can't remember much more of this. Not tearing their hair, but can't remember what it was. Ambrose believed that this section, and perhaps all of the Green Book, represented a survival of folk ritual, perhaps to appease the white folk or to harness their power for the user. He used to say that many dark things were cloaked in simple stories of fairies and humble rural superstition. I rolled my eyes a bit at that one, humble rural superstition. Ambrose sounded like a bit of a jerk, the sort of person who'd stand by the maypole at the Renaissance Festival and tell you that actually it was a fertility rite, like you didn't bloody well know. Hey. You eating lunch? Asked Foxy. I let out a squawk and lurched backward, nearly knocking the chair over. Papers went everywhere. Sorry, said Foxy. She leaned against the screen door and waited for me to unlatch it. You got that radio up so loud, I could walk a brass band past the door. Yeah, I said, picking up papers hurriedly. Yeah, it's... I needed noise. She nodded. I let her into the house, and she handed me a Tupperware container with a sandwich in it. Skip made tuna salad. I figured you were probably working yourself into a state, so I came over. Thanks, Skip, for me. I wolfed down the sandwich and realized I could have eaten about 10 more. I've been drinking coffee all this time. I didn't realize it was lunchtime. It ain't. Said Foxy. It's closing in on supper. It'll be dark soon, and I figured I'd come sit up with you tonight. I looked at her blankly. In the house? She said patiently. Tonight, in case your monster comes back. You'd do that? Well, of course. Her bangles clacked together as she flailed her hands in the air. You don't let your neighbors get it by monsters alone. Thomas would do it, but he's a boy, so it wouldn't be respectable. And I ain't sure how much he knows about the holler people. They got different stuff going on where he's from, or maybe the same stuff walking around in different skins. I shuddered at the mental image, vague though it was. You mean in Mexico? No, I mean Arizona. Thomas is from Phoenix. And I'm a racist ass. And here I was just yelling at Cockgrave about that. Never been out that way myself, Foxy continued. But he says they got a whole tribe way back when who built big cliff houses and then vanished off the face of the earth. She pointed a finger at me. Mind you, we got that out here too, that lost colony they do the play about. I'm pretty sure that colony went off and lived with the local tribes, I said weakly. Apparently that happened a lot back then. Foxy dismissed the weight of decades of archaeology with a wave of her hand. Well, maybe, but I ain't convinced. And there ain't any of those local tribes around talking about it, are there? I opened my mouth to launch into a diatribe about why there were no local tribes, then thought better of it.
While I am generally willing to rant at people about smallpox and colonialism, this did not seem like an opportune time. If I lived through the night, I could find Foxy a book on the topic. At the moment, I had something else for her to read. "Foxy, I'm in the middle of reading this manuscript my step-grandfather wrote. Would you mind reading it too?" She raised one painted-on eyebrow. "A manuscript? What sort of thing?" "I think it's about the Holler people." Her other eyebrow went up. "Oh," she said. "All right, then. Let's see what the old man had to say." Foxy wanted to head back home before it got dark and bring over a sleeping bag. I dragged the cushions off the couch and set them up in the kitchen for her. The wraparound porch didn't run under the kitchen window, and I didn't think the deer monster would be tall enough to look through it unless it could run up the walls like a spider. "Stop. Stop. Don't think about that." I played another game of solitaire to settle my brain. Then I went to the stairs and the wall of junk. Had I seen a tea kettle in there earlier? I could swear I had. Aha! The kettle was lurking under a grid of wire coat hangers and a dish drying rack with a broken hinge. It took some wiggling, and there was a dent in the side, but I managed to haul it free. I scrubbed it out and was heating water for tea by the time Foxy returned. "I brought more sandwiches," she said, holding up more Tupperware. "I'll make coffee," I said, "or tea." The tea bags in the cupboard were about 1,000 years old, but Lipton doesn't go bad, does it? "Or do you drink tea?" "I'll drink just about anything, hon." She patted her purse. "Brought something to put in it, too." "Is it a good idea to be drunk if there are, things out there?" Foxy snorted. "You kidding? It's the best idea." We settled back down. I took my chair again, and Foxy sat in an armchair that I'd managed to liberate from the newspapers. I passed the pages over as I finished them. The radio droned pleasantly in the background. It could almost have been cozy, if things weren't so deeply bizarre. Together, we settled down to read.
"There is a story of a young man happening on the secret rites, but it follows the ordinary sort of cautionary tale, where a man looks on forbidden knowledge. I think this is a different young man from the one who visited the Queen of Fairies, but I fear it has been too long to be sure. There were too many young men in the stories, and they have all blurred together in my head. He is bound up by some invisible force and wakes the next morning. When he tries to tell the villagers what he has seen, those who go to the rites already know but will not speak of it. The rites are largely unspecific except for making a sound like thunder, which is probably the use of a bull roarer or other primitive instrument. Supposedly, this sound is answered from far away. Bread and wine are passed around, and secret things brought out." Ambrose pointed out the connections here to the Eleusinian mysteries, but I have always considered this tenuous at best. One could describe a high mass nearly the same way, with bread and wine and smoke and singing. Somewhere in these descriptions, the nurse takes her to make a clay doll, keeping it hidden, doing queer things with it. She describes the nurse as making such funny red faces while she kneads the clay, singing the entire time, while her face gets redder and redder. The nurse impresses the importance of secrecy on her, with more threats of being thrown in the black pit. It was long after I came here, and after Ambrose died, that I learned of the hoodoo men in the South who claim to make dolls, or puppets, and can use them to cast sickness on a person. Voodoo dolls have become a silly toy on television programs now, like firewalking. If there is some grain of truth to these stories, I would not be surprised if it is related to the clay doll in the Green Book. They perform strange rites with the doll, paying their respects. The narrator does as the nurse does, calling it an odd game that they are playing, but agrees to do what the nurse does because she likes her. She gives no details. She says that the nurse looks at this time like the white lady from the wood. I'll be honest, if I heard this from a modern narrator, I would have child protective services on the line so fast it would make your head spin. All this stuff about odd games that have to be kept secret set off serious warning bells. But, well, different era, different language. Maybe this wasn't as creepy as it seemed. Or maybe it was, but I couldn't very well call the cops on a book. I was a bit surprised that neither Ambrose nor Cotgrave commented on that, but then again, they were also from a far older time when I suppose you just didn't talk about that sort of thing. On the other hand, if you were summoning up people from another world and making, I don't know, the English equivalent of voodoo dolls, you'd probably want to keep that secret too. Maybe it was just perfectly innocent devil worship. I rubbed my forehead. You're thinking awfully hard, said Foxy, turning a page. There's a lot to think about, I said. How far have you gotten? She's going a long, 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 long way, said Foxy. I'm getting the impression it was a bit of a walk. Do you think her white people are the holler people? If they aren't, they're at least kissing cousins. Foxy rubbed her forearms, setting her bracelets clicking. I don't know. She's a strange one, isn't she? Yes, I said, more strongly than I meant to. Or Cotgrave's writing her strange. I don't know. I don't like her. Well, she's been dead a good long while, Foxy pointed out, so I don't think that's going to hurt her none. I exhaled. I had been feeling a strange sort of guilt about it. A bright young girl caught up with a clearly bizarre nurse in peculiar circumstances. I should have felt sorry for her. Instead, I edited a manuscript once that wasn't terrible. Most of it was pretty good, but they'd tried to do a point of view thing with a feral child, and that bit had been completely dreadful. It had read pretty much exactly like a reasonably smart man trying to write like he thought a naive innocent would write, and it had come off like Norman Mailer trying to write virginity, only with more eating bugs in the woods. This wasn't that bad, but it was, as Foxy would say, kissin' cousins. I mean, it might have been Cotgrave. Maybe he was transcribing it wrong. But there was something strange about the girl in this book. I couldn't put my finger on any one thing. I didn't trust her, or her stupid semicolons. Maybe Cotgrave's just leaving out the sympathetic parts, I said, struggling to be fair. Could be, agreed Foxy. Anyway, I'll tell you in a bit. She's still going the long, long, long way around. I thought the stones sounded like the ones on the hill, I said. Foxy grunted. Only seen 'em once, she admitted, years ago. And I turned right the hill around and left again. Those things weren't right. There's one in the backyard, I said. She looked over the edge of the paper at me. Didn't know that. Should we do something with it? I asked. Like, bury it? Or smash it or something? Foxy dropped the paper in her lap and waved her hands. How the hell should I know? I'd say burn the thing, but I don't know if you can burn rocks. You can if you get them hot enough, I said. I guess we could find a volcano.
I had a mad image of Foxy and me, two unlikely hobbits lugging a 200-pound rock to Mount Doom.
Not a lot of volcanoes in this neck of the woods, she said.
She took out a silver flask and poured several healthy glugs into her mug of tea.
Let me finish reading this thing, and then we can go take a look at your evil rock.
Technically, I think it was my grandmother's evil rock, not mine. She grinned down at the paper.
There is a story of a puppet like this one, owned by a beautiful woman of the high gentry who lived in a great castle.
And she was so beautiful that all the gentlemen wanted to marry her because she was the loveliest lady that anybody had ever seen, and she was kind to everybody, and everybody thought she was very good.
The lady puts her suitors off for a year and a day, but one disguises himself as a girl to hide in the castle and befriend one of the maids. It is a plot worthy of the bard, but the lady is more akin to one of Macbeth's witches.
She knew more of the secret things than anyone else, and more than anyone knew before or after, because she would not tell anybody the most secret secrets. She knew how to do all the awful things, how to destroy young men, and how to put a curse on people, and other things.
There may have been another awful thing here, but I cannot remember it.
And the dancing people called her Cassip, which meant somebody very wise in the old language. And she was whiter than any of them, and taller, and her eyes shone in the dark like burning rubies. And she could sing songs that none of the others could sing. And when she sang, they all fell down on their faces and worshipped her. And she could do whatever they called shibshow, which was a very wonderful enchantment.
Neither Ambrose nor my later research turned up anything on either the title Cassip or shibshow. Shibshow, as described in the text, is a kind of taming of serpents. The serpents leave her a gift called a gleam stone, which is presumably derived from the same root as glamour. Her description as being whiter and taller than others, with eyes like burning rubies, would indicate that she was one of the white people herself. A changeling? One trapped on this side? Or simply amusing herself among humankind? At any rate, the lady has a poppet made of beeswax, which the narrator compares to the one her nurse made out of clay. She feeds it and bathes it in wine, and it becomes a man who kisses her. It becomes clear that the poppet is her true husband, although unlike the story of the black man, this one appears to be subservient to her. She makes more wax dolls and assigns them each the name of one of her suitors, then ritually kills them off one by one, drowning, burning, and strangling them with violet cords. When only the disguised young man is left alive, he goes to the bishop and reveals everything. It is worth noting that there are multiple suitors, and after two or three had been killed, he might easily have gone to the bishop and thus saved several of his rivals. But the author of The Green Book never comments on this. The Lady Cassip is burned alive, with her wax husband hung around her neck, and the puppet is said to scream when it burns.
And I thought of this story again and again as I was lying awake in my bed, and I imagined the lady in the marketplace with the yellow flames eating up her beautiful white body. And I thought of it so much that I seemed to get into the story myself, and I fancied I was the lady and that they were coming to take me to be burnt with fire, with all the people in the town looking at me. And I wondered whether she cared after all the strange things she had done, and whether it hurt very much to be burned at the stake.
Much of the rest of the Green Book is of no great account. The girl writes rambling comments about whether anything she has learned is really true, about stories in her head, which she does not explain, and ruminates on the wonderful secret that she knows, but she never reveals it. She mentions a few things that her nurse has taught her. Nurse said she would show me something funny that would make me laugh, and then she showed me how one could turn a whole house upside down, and the pots and pans would jump about, and the china would be broken. She reveals that her nurse went away some years before, and no one knows where she had gone, and that her father had been angry when she spoke of the stories the nurse had told. She also mentions an old game called Troy Town, where one dances a pattern and then must answer questions truthfully. Oh, was that earlier? I can't remember. It might have been when she talked about the rituals and the bull roarers. There is no organization to the book, and it has been so long since I read it. Troy Towns are, of course, our common labyrinths, though they do not call them that much over here. Americans seem uninterested in labyrinths and mazes. Probably they require too much mental effort. Thanks, Cockgrave. Nobody deserved to marry my grandmother, but apparently some people didn't deserve it less than others. I glanced over at Foxy. She had nearly caught up to me, only a page or two behind. She must have sensed me looking at her and glanced up. They say people used to go up in the hills and do devil things here too, in the old days, she said. But it was mostly moonshiners, and I expect they put the stories about to keep people off their stills. And the clan, of course. She made a gesture as if to spit, and then remembered she was indoors. They're dumb enough to mess around with the hollers, I expect, but too dumb to live through it. I snorted. Moonshiners and white supremacists. Lovely. If that was what Cockgrave was seeing up in the hills, I could see how he'd gone sarcastic about Americans. It surprises me, though, I said. I mean, I wandered onto that hill. You'd think more drunk kids would do the same thing. I could picture two frat boys wandering around the hill, trying to knock over stones and refusing to admit to each other that things had gone strange. I doubt it happens much, she said. You followed your dog, didn't you? I nodded. I'm only guessing, you understand, but I think there's probably different ways to the hills. Animals know ways through stuff that we don't. That one time I saw the stones, you know? Been out deer hunting and only clipped them.
Well, you don't let a deer bleed out and leave it lying. It ain't right. So I went after, and next thing I knew, I was more than halfway up that hill and saw the stones.
Only time I ever let a deer fall and not brought it back, but I wasn't chasing anything into that country.
She took another slug of tea and bourbon.
I never could find my way back on my own, but I ain't saying I tried very hard either.
I let out a long sigh. It didn't mean that I'd get Bongo back, but the idea that I might not be driving down the road and suddenly slip into a terrible different dimension relieved a fear I hadn't realized that I'd been harboring. The idea that you could just be walking and one minute you were in the world and the next everything changed and was full of gray stones and white people and effigies? I said as much to Foxy, or tried to.
Nah, not so much. Oh, I expect that now and again there's ways people go through on accident, but not often. And they either get out or they go missing.
Or get eaten by deer monsters, I said.
There's always that, sure.
An example of the ramblings in this section that I remember.
But I shall always remember those days if I live to be quite old, because all the time I felt so strange, wondering and doubting, and feeling quite sure at one time and making up my mind. And then I would feel quite sure that such things couldn't happen, really.
More such here. Cannot remember exact words.
But I took great care not to do certain things that might be very dangerous. So I waited and wondered for a long time, and though I was not sure at all, I never dared to try to find out. But one day, I became sure that all that Nurse said was quite true, and I was all alone when I found it out.
The cause of the narrator's moment of revelation is obscured. Ambrose believed it might be caused by the menarche, traditionally a highly dangerous time in the spiritual life of women.
Oh, gag me, I thought. Your first period's not dangerous unless you plan on wearing white pants. Freaks you the hell out, sure, particularly if nobody bothered to explain it. Foxy was a fast reader. She got to that section a few minutes after I did. I could tell by the explosive snort. Just like men, she muttered. Periods scare the crap out of them, so they assume the whole damn world's scared of it, too. Thank you, I said with feeling. Although I suppose this nurse could have told her she'd start bleeding, and she took it as proof of everything else, too, Foxy added. I grunted.
Then she decides to repeat her journey to the Grey Stones to see the secret again. She makes a puppet of her own.
A much finer image than the one her nurse had made, and when it was finished, I did everything that I could imagine and much more than she did, because it was the likeness of something far better.
She makes no further mention of the puppet or what it was used for.
And a few days later, when I had done my lessons early, I went for the second time by the way of the little brook that had led me into a strange country, a long, long way.
At one point she turns and sees the countryside behind her resolve into two figures, and remembers a story in which the two figures are called Adam and Eve. She blindfolds herself with a red silk handkerchief.
Then I began to go on, step by step, very slowly. My heart beat faster and faster, and something rose in my throat that choked me and made me want to cry.
Something else here, not sure.
Boughs caught in my hair as I went, and great thorns tore me, but I went on to the end of the path. Then I stopped and held out my arms and bowed, and I went around the first time, feeling with my hands, and there was nothing. I went round the second time, feeling with my hands, and there was nothing. Then I went round the third time, feeling with my hands, and the story was all true, and I wished that the years were gone by, and that I had not so long a time to wait before I was happy forever and ever.
Neither Ambrose nor I were ever entirely clear about this section, but it seems likely that the narrator realized that she herself was a changeling or descendant of the white people, and that she will at some point return to her own people. She looks in the water and remembers the white lady that she saw before, presumably comparing her reflection to that figure and believing that the lady must be her mother. The green book cuts off abruptly shortly after this. She remembers about nymphs, which she must look for everywhere, and some are dark and some are bright, and resolves to go and call them up. The last words are,
"The dark nymph, Alana, came, and she turned the pool of water into a pool of fire."
Ambrose believed that the nymphs were references to certain alchemical processes, couched by the narrator in somewhat childish terms. This then would indicate that the narrator has learned to control some of those processes, perhaps in the form of prayers to nymphs.
In a more mature mind, Ambrose speculated, we might see them as a recitation of the formulas required for a certain result, perhaps somewhat like a mathematical equation.
The ancient alchemists undoubtedly knew such formulas, but they cast them in mystical terms too, like virgin's milk and the philosopher's stone. The green book was not very long, and the narrator had reached the end of it, with the last line written on the end paper itself. Ambrose did tell me of what he called the sequel to the green book, a story only, in which the girl was found dead before a white stone statue in the woods, perhaps a year after the writing of the green book. So much for dying in bed at 100 years old, I thought. Well, if she was in her late teens, and Ambrose was old enough to be a friend of her father, oh, hell, I couldn't make sense of the chronology. Late 1800s, maybe, assuming Ambrose had been holding on to the green book for a while. Maybe a little later. I still didn't know if Cotgrave had met Ambrose before or after the war. It didn't matter now, I supposed. Everyone was dead, except the Holler people, and me, and, please God, my dog. I pressed him on the subject, and he at last relented enough to say that the girl's father had called him in, and the statue, which he had seen, was an image of copulating beings. He said that he would be hard-pressed to describe those beings, being a representation of things belonging to heaven or hell, not to earth, but that they were of two different kinds, and the offspring of such a union would be most terrible. He went on to say that the statue was known to have been incorporated into the mythology of the witches' sabbat. I wish now that I had asked where he knew that last bit from, but Ambrose enjoyed his secrets, particularly if they had a questionable bibliography behind them. The girl, he suggested, had seen the statue once by chance, and then had blindfolded herself to avoid seeing it again. It is likely that one day the blindfold slipped, or perhaps she took it off deliberately, and then perhaps she became impregnated by the forces of the statue through a sympathetic process, though Ambrose hastened to say that her virtue was intact and she was blameless in the conventional sense, even if she had, quite by accident, stormed the gates of heaven. In any event, the servants had noted her comings and goings and the changes associated with pregnancy, and so jumped to conclusions. When she was found dead, Ambrose was called in, and he had the statue destroyed. The nurse could not be found. I scowled over the pages. I'd been thinking that this statue was the same as the white stone I had seen, but clearly it must not have been, because the stone was intact. Unless it was a different stone, unless there was more than one. Well, why wouldn't there be more than one? If Ambrose's stone was in Wales, the Holler people could have another one over here. It'd be pretty inconvenient to cross the Atlantic whenever you needed to get a confused teenager knocked up by a rock. The fact that I even had to think this sentence was probably proof that things had gotten badly out of hand. The pregnancy killed her in the end, poisoned by knowledge beyond her understanding, Ambrose said. He did not say at the time whether she had borne what she carried, or whether her body had proved too frail to contain the forces within. It seems unlikely, in that time, that her father would have consented to an autopsy, particularly as Ambrose was not a medical doctor. But the stone itself was in the woods, not terribly far from human haunts. I wish that I had never learned that. It is not pleasant to think that there may be such forces in the world lying in wait for the unsuspecting to stumble over. It is even less pleasant now that I have discovered what lies behind the house. The hill of stones is there. I saw it once, but I knew to look away. The second time, though, I sought the stones out like a fool. I was close to falling into Ambrose's sin, I know. Now I wish that I had never gone and never seen them. I got away from them in Wales, but blood calls blood, and I climbed the hill at last. If I had stayed away the second time. But there is no point now in wishing. If Ambrose were alive, I would ask him about those twisted stones, but he is not, so I must make my own guesses. The white people carved them, of that there is no doubt. Perhaps one of them might derive information from such a stone, like a man reading a signpost. Perhaps the Hill of Stones is a vast library of knowledge, which I am too blind and mortal to comprehend. And I twisted myself about like the twisted ones. And I twisted myself about like the twisted ones. This phrase rings in my head, but I no longer believe it was meant for me. The writer of the Green Book knew many things, and she knew there were things she should not write down, but she was young and untrained. It is not surprising that perhaps a phrase bled over imperfectly, and I find myself saying these words like an incantation against the darkness in my mind. There is a girl in the woods that I see sometimes now, and I have tried to warn her away. But what can I say? I am an old man who is not allowed to rest, and I sound mad if I say, "Don't look at the stones on the hill, or you will be a mother of monsters." If I had the strength, I should go and find the white stone and hammer it down, as Ambrose did. But I do not know, in practical terms, if I am strong enough to wield the hammer. If Ambrose were alive, perhaps he would have some idea what to do. But it has been a long time since we had those conversations. I don't even know if I am remembering them right myself. If Ambrose were alive, if I were stronger, I have become an old man, obsessed with the tasks I can no longer finish. I have done my best. It seems unlikely that my mind will ever be clearer than it is now. I have written the Green Book down as best as I can recall. I thought I would remember more than I did. I certify that all that I have written is accurate to the best of my recollection. And if parts are blurred or forgotten, it is a failure of memory and not of will. Frederick Cotgrave, United States of America, but once of Wales, March 1998.